Welcome, writers, to our new episode on writing fiction, both novels and short stories. I'm glad we're together for it. This is Jim Thayer. Imagine the satisfaction if you were a bricklayer, to look upon a new and beautiful brick house where you had laid the bricks, putting down mortar and bricks layer after layer until there was a house. If I were a bricklayer, I'd have a sense of joy looking on something I'd built. There was nothing on that piece of land, and then there's a brick house, and I did it. What a wonderful feeling. We writers create something from nothing. Here is one of my favorite paragraphs in literature. It's Charles Dickens's description of Ebenezer Scrooge. Imagine Charles Dickens at his desk, his feather pen in his hand, and there's nothing on his page. It's blank. Then he begins to write, and he writes this. Oh, but he was a tight-fisted hand at the grindstone. Scrooge, a squeezing, wrenching, grasping, scraping, clutching, covetous old sinner, hard and sharp as flint from which no steel had ever struck out generous fire, secret and self-contained and solitary as an oyster. The cold within him froze his old features, nipped his pointed nose, shriveled his cheek, stiffened his gait, made his eyes red, his thin lips blue, and spoke out shrewdly in his grating voice. A frosty rime was on his head and on his eyebrows and his wiry chin. He carried his own low temperature always about with him. He iced his office in the dog days, and he didn't thaw it 1 degree at Christmas. Charles Dickens may not have known it when he dashed off that paragraph, but he certainly came to know it later in his life, that with his pen and paper he had created one of literature's great characters. Today, through the novel A Christmas Carol and through movies and stage plays, much of the world knows about Ebenezer Scrooge. Like a bricklayer, Charles Dickens created Scrooge from nothing. What did Dickens feel when he did so? I think I know how he felt. Pure joy at his creation. Here is Neil Gaiman in his novel Neverwhere, one of my favorite novels, where if you fall through the cracks in the world, you end up in a wonderful and weird place called London Below. Here's the author. Richard stood there, alone in the throng, drinking it in. It was pure madness. Of that there was no doubt at all. It was loud and brash and insane, and it was, in many ways, quite wonderful. People argued, haggled, shouted, sang. They hawked and touted their wares and loudly declaimed the superiority of their merchandise. Music was playing, a dozen different kinds of music being played a dozen different ways on a score of different instruments, most of them improvised, improved, improbably. Richard could smell food, all kinds of food. The smells of curries and spices seemed to predominate, with beneath them the smells of grilling meats and mushrooms. Stalls had been set up all throughout the shop, next to or even on counters that during the day had sold perfume or watches or amber or silk scarves. Everybody was buying, everybody was selling. Richard listened to the market cries as he began to wander through the crowds. Lovely, fresh dreams, first-class nightmares. We got 'em. Get your lovely nightmares here. Weapons, arm yourself, defend your cellar, cave, or hole. You want to hit 'em? We got 'em. Come on, darling, come on over here. One stall was piled high with bottles, full bottles and empty bottles of every shape and every size, from bottles of booze to one huge glimmering bottle that could have contained nothing but a captive genie. Another sold lamps with candles made of many kinds of wax and tallow. A man thrust what appeared to be a severed hand clutching a candle toward him as he passed, muttering, "Hand of glory, sir, send them the wooden hilt of Bedfordshire, guaranteed to work. He passed a stall selling glittering gold and silver jewelry, another selling jewelry made from what looked like the valves and wires of antique radios. There were stalls that sold every manner of book and magazine, others that sold clothes, old clothes patched and mended and made strange, several tattooists, a dentist's chair with a hand-operated manual drill, with a line of miserable people standing beside it waiting to have their teeth pulled or filled by a young man who seemed to be having altogether too good a time, a bent old man selling unlikely things that might have been hats and might have been modern art, something that looked very much like a portable shower facility, even a blacksmith's. He goes on, "That's from Neil Gaiman. What a skilled writer. I suspect Neil Gaiman is a modest fellow, but imagine him typing these paragraphs of description of London below, and then rereading them. He created this marvelous place. It wasn't there. It didn't exist until Gaiman created it. Now it's there. What a joyous feeling that'd be. So let's try inventing something from nothing. We start out with nothing. I wrote this paragraph a few moments ago." Kelly pressed his back against the cliff face, which rose 200 feet above him. The path was 1 foot wide, covered in rock shards and tufts of sedge. The shards glittered with mica. The cliff rose above Kelly, and it also fell below him, a sheer drop of 300 feet to the Alsek River. A precipice above and a precipice below, with this one path between. And this path, chipped out of the living rock by early miners, seemed to shrink in front of his eyes. Blue-green lichen grew on the cliff above, and a stumpy, bent Sitka spruce tree somehow clung to the rock face a foot below the path. The St. Elias Mountains were in the distance, softened by blue haze. Kelly inched sideways along the path, accidentally kicking over the edge pebbles that fell into space. That's the end of the piece. Mount St. Elias and the Alsek River in Alaska exist, but this narrow, dangerous path on the side of the mountain doesn't exist in real life, nor does the character Kelly, nor does his predicament. I invented them. But now this place and this person do exist on my screen and in my mind, and because you're listening, in your minds. They came from nothing, and now they're there. It's like magic. And there's much fun and exhilaration for us writers in creating places and people and putting together scenes. Isaac Newton, maybe the most intelligent person in human history, spent the last third of his life trying to turn lead into gold, alchemy. He couldn't figure it out, and nor has anyone since. But we writers have an alchemy. We can turn nothing into something. What a wonderful feeling. I hope that's one of the reasons you write, being able to create people and places and events, building a world, and I hope you get a feeling of joy when you do. I received a nice email from Alicia in California. She said, "My issue is this plot point or device compelling or convincing? I find some plot points unconvincing in bestsellers, yet overall the book is great." Alicia's question is, how do I know if a plot point is compelling or convincing? What a big question, and what an important question. Let me try to answer it. You, the writer, have invented a new turn, a new twist, or you've added a new plot point in your story. Is it any good? I am unaware of a formula that will reveal whether our new plot invention is good. A character falls down an elevator shaft. Our hero says goodbye to her son. The villain steals an army tank. Our character sits down at a poker table. Our 12-year-old character reaches for a girl's hand to hold. Our character puts on a mask and jumps into the water. She plans to go to a huge homecoming party. Are these strong plot points? I'm going to offer some thoughts on how we might judge plot points. As I mentioned, there's no formula, at least that I'm aware of, but maybe there are some questions we can ask ourselves about the new turn of events in our story, our new plot inventions. Something big happens in our story. We've introduced a new plot point, or we're planning on it. Will it work? Is it any good? First question, does it make sense? Yeah, I know this is obvious and maybe not too helpful, but we should remember that readers like causality in fiction. A causes B. B causes C. I open my hand and the ball drops to the floor. It's a natural sequence. One thing follows the other. If our scene is followed by one that logically follows the first one, the earlier one, it may be a good scene. At least, it likely won't be a nonsensical, out-of-the-blue scene. But that's not true of all successful scenes, of course. Sometimes scenes in fiction occur for reasons that aren't apparent to the reader at the time. That's how a writer can build mystery and tension. But if the first scene is explained later, fully and logically explained in a later scene, then the first scene holds up. And that's due to causality. If A, then B. I know this isn't too useful. The sum of it is, does the scene or will the scene make sense? If there's a cause and effect, is there one? Does the cause have an effect, and does the effect have a cause? A second question we can ask is, does the new plot point increase pressure on the protagonist? We've mentioned before that novels are documents of trouble. In fiction, only trouble is interesting. This sometimes is a difficult concept for new writers, but it's true. Does our new plot point add trouble? If so, it might be a strong plot point. And related to that, a strong plotting technique is for the writer to place obstacles in front of the protagonist. In most successful stories, most successful fiction, the hero overcomes one thing after another. So a question for us to ask about our new plot point, is it an obstacle? And does the obstacle flow from the story? Obstacles can be strong plot points. And another question we can ask, is there something fresh in the new plot point? Well, this is a fuzzy parameter, I know. With tens of thousands of movies and TV shows and novels, maybe nothing is fresh. The literary agent Donald Moss has said, quote, there are certainly no new plots, not a one. There are also no settings that have not been used, and no professions that have not been given to protagonists. That's Donald Moss. What about smaller aspects, such as a plot point that we're considering? Maybe Donald Moss's point is true here, too. Nothing is new. It's all been done before. But some things have been done to death, again and again, maybe because the authors didn't look for something fresh. Is our new plot point a family conversation around the dining table or a car chase scene in an underground parking garage? Is our boy meets girl, our meet cute scene too cute? If we're thinking of these, maybe we can put some extra time into our plotting and come up with something fresher. Maybe we can offer the reader something, if not new, something with different angles, something with more pop. We're creative. That's one of the reasons we like writing novels. If we put some time thinking into it, we can come up with something fresh, or at least fresher. So those are my thoughts about how to tell if a new plot point, a new turn of events in our story, is a strong one. First, does it or will it make sense? Second, does the new plot point increase pressure on the protagonist? Third, is there something fresh in the new plot point? These three questions aren't a formula we can shove our new plot point through and find the answer to whether it's a good plot point. I don't think there is such a formula, but they might be good questions to ask ourselves about our new plot angle. Another joy in writing is creating a compelling villain. Right now I'm reading Charles Dickens' novel Hard Times, which features the dastardly school superintendent Thomas Gradgrind and the equally odious Mr. McChokemchild. Where did Dickens come up with these names? In fiction, how's this for being profound? Villains are good. In an Entertainment Weekly magazine article, Stephen King, a master at creating villains, of course, listed his favorite fictional villains. Here they are, along with King's explanations from Entertainment Weekly, from number 10 to number 1, the worst. And this is Stephen King. Number 10, Max Cady. Don't recognize the name? Would it help if I said Cape Fear? Cady is the crazed for revenge psychopath who stalks the Bowden family in John D. MacDonald's The Executioners from 1957. Played on the silver screen by Robert Mitchum in 1962 and Robert De Niro in 1991, but never more scary than in MacDonald's tightly wrapped novels. That's Stephen King. Let me mention, when I was much younger, I read everything I could get my hands on by John D. MacDonald. What a wonderful writer. Number 9 in Stephen King's list of the worst villains is Anton Chigurh, Cormac McCarthy's scariest creation, Stephen King says. And he goes on, mostly, I think, because of Chigurh's weapon of choice, an air-driven cattle gun that shoots a retracting pneumatic bolt. Number 8, Popeye. Not the cartoon sailor, but the small-town criminal in William Faulkner's Sanctuary. He commits the most infamous rape in modern fiction. It's so gruesome that I can't describe it in a family magazine. Number 7 in Stephen King's list in Entertainment Weekly, Big Brother. Stephen King says, he's watching you from every telescreen in George Orwell's more relevant than ever novel of a nightmare dictatorship where war is peace, freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength, and one man struggles for a better, saner life. Good luck on that. Number 6, Harry Powell, the preacher who hounds two children through the pages of Davis Grubb's Night of the Hunter. He has love tattooed on the fingers of one hand and hate on the fingers of the other. Let me add, well, who doesn't? In the film version, Robert Mitchum gave him the face that caused 1,000 nightmares. Number 5 in Stephen King's list is Rhoda Penmark. What a sweet little 8-year-old kid. Too bad she's a cold-blooded murderer. Patty McCormick gave her all as Rhoda in the film version of The Bad Seed, but during the mid-50s, Hollywood was in full prude mode, and the movie is oddly lifeless. For a true malevolence, you have to go to William March's novel. Number 4 from Stephen King, Voldemort. Stephen King says, he tried to kill Harry Potter and all his friends. Do I have to say more? Number 3 is Sauron. Probably the prototype for Voldemort, but even scarier and with bigger ambitions. Bloated with the power and the evil of the Great Ring, the villain of Tolkien's trilogy wants to destroy everything. Number 2 on King's list is Pazuzu. And King says, the demon who possesses Regan in William Peter Blatty's 1971 novel, The Exorcist. Linda Blair's portrayal of the haunted little girl was frightening, but the demon who lives in the pages is far scarier. And then, number 1 on Stephen King's list of dastardly villains is Count Dracula. King writes, Bram Stoker's courtly, sinister creation is still literature's greatest villain, and although he's been portrayed on the screen by a dozen actors, Christopher Lee is surely the best of them, none can equal the one in the book. And Stoker's most amazing achievement? After the first 100 pages, the sanguinary Count mostly lurks off stage. It's a lesson for all of us. Villains are scarier in the shadows. That's Stephen King's list. And then he adds, not satisfied, here are a few that didn't make the top 10. Tom Ripley, from the novels of Patricia Highsmith. Frederick Clegg, who tires of mounting butterflies and kidnaps a girl in John Fowles's The Collector. Cora Papadakis, the amoral sexpot in The Postman Always Rings Twice by James M. Cain. Drake Merwin, the psycho teenager in Michael Grant's extraordinary YA novel, Gone. Jaws, from the Peter Benchley novel. Norman Bates, from Psycho by Robert Bloch. Miss Havisham, from Dickens's Great Expectations. And, of course, Thomas Harris's signature creation, Hannibal Lecter. And then he adds, others? Dozens. For instance, there was this dog named Cujo. This has been Stephen King's list. It's a terrific one of his favorite villains from his article in Entertainment Weekly. As writers, wouldn't it be a pleasure to create a villain that would make Stephen King's list? We can try. I received a nice message from a listener, and I want to mention again a small but important technique about dialogue paragraphing. Yeah, it's hyper-technical, but it's important for us writers to get it right. We want the agent and publisher to focus on our dialogue, not focus on mistakes presenting the dialogue. I call it the new person, new paragraph technique. And it's this. Generally, when one person speaks, it's in one paragraph. If a second character then acts, thinks, or speaks, another new paragraph is needed. Then when the first character speaks again, another new paragraph is needed. That's it. That's the technique. So usually you don't want one character speaking and another character acting in the same paragraph. Here's an example. Our two characters are Josh and Amy, and Amy is teaching her younger brother Josh to ride a bicycle. Here's our sentence in the story. Amy said, I'll hold you up. She grabbed the bike's back fender. That's our first two sentences, our first sentence of dialogue, and then a sentence of action. And because it's followed by, our dialogue's followed by Amy's action, she grabs the fender, that sentence, she grabbed the bike's back fender, can be in the same paragraph as her dialogue. So we have our first paragraph, dialogue, and that same person, Amy's action. Then Josh speaks, so it needs to be in a new paragraph. So our new paragraph is this, quote, I hope I don't fall off. End quote, or period, end quote. Josh put both hands on his handlebars. Just like our first paragraph of Amy's dialogue and action, here Josh speaks, I hope I don't fall off, and then acts. He puts both hands on the handlebars. So his dialogue and his action can be in the same paragraph. It's our second paragraph. And then Amy speaks again, which should not be in the same paragraph as Josh speaking and acting. It needs a new paragraph. So our new paragraph is this. I'll hold you up, Amy said. That's a new paragraph of dialogue, and it has only dialogue. And then we have yet a new paragraph. Josh put a foot on a pedal. Here, Josh is acting. He's putting his foot on a pedal. So it needs to be in a new paragraph. You don't want this sentence of Josh's action, him putting his foot on a pedal, to be in the earlier paragraph of Amy speaking. New person, Josh, new paragraph. If two characters are acting without speaking, it can go in the same paragraphs. My examples here where you are listening to the examples rather than reading them might sound complicated, but it isn't. A character's dialogue and action can go in the same paragraph. If another character acts or speaks or thinks, it needs to be in a new paragraph. New person, new paragraph is a phrase I use to remember it. That's it for today. This is Jim Thayer here in Seattle. I hope you have a wonderful writing project going, and please keep tapping those keys.